For the week of September 15th, 2013, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 205, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Gill.
Well, Michael, before we even get started today, I want to play you a little something from a listener whose name I don't even know, and I'd like to thank them for calling us, actually, and letting us know about a particular situation with our feed, our website, how they were getting the podcast on iTunes.
Let it roll.
Hey, Sperling. Oops, 204 isn't kicking through again on iTunes, so please correct it. Oh, and Michael has passed you up officially as the Segway King. Got to work on that next time for 205. Thanks, bye.
And to this I say, what? What? Michael is the Segway King? Oh, wait, actually, the other thing was more important, I will admit. But still.
It doesn't seem fair. I mean, if we were going to rank us, I guess we'd be number one and two. But if we're going to rank the top stories of the week, what would they be?
Oh, wow, you're just trying to get into it. I just wanted to thank this listener.
I already got another segue. That's what I was doing.
Oh, I get it. It's very good. You're actually proving him right. That's just wonderful. Just wonderful. Well, you know, whoever that was, thank you so much for letting us know. I worked on it all weekend with our podcast host. And we are trying to rectify the issue. We have no idea why this is occurring, and we appreciate you letting us know. Feel free to let us know whenever anything like that happens. And all of your calls and emails are much appreciated. Of course, you can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com, or you can call us, just like that listener did, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. But Michael, you asked about today's show.
That's right.
On today's show, we're going to be speaking with Anne Thompson from IndieWire. She's just back from the Telluride and Toronto Film Festivals, and she's going to let us know what we have to look forward to going into the awards season. This is one of my favorite shows of the year because we get to talk to Anne about all the great movies we're going to see. We'll also discuss the passing of audio pioneer Ray Dolby and whether the motion picture industry may be discouraging future inventors from working in the space.
I'm open to talking about that.
Okay. Well, we're going to wrap up by talking about a little controversy over, well, reporting, or more specifically, not reporting, digital sales. And by that, I mean digital sales figures. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And we're talking about box office around the world. And the number one film around the world is, of course, Insidious Chapter 2. It grossed $46 million, most of that in the U.S., where it debuted at number one. It's the new film starring Patrick Wilson, who has now supplanted Jamie Lee Curtis as the king of Scream. She was the queen of Scream, thanks to Halloween and some other movies. And Patrick Wilson has been in Insidious, The Conjuring, which was a big hit earlier this year. It's still in the theaters. And now Insidious Chapter 2, which opened in 2013 on Friday the 13th and made a ton of money. This is the big film in the country right now.
I think it was just because it was Friday the 13th, frankly.
That certainly helped, but, you know, the first one was successful. This one's making money, too. And number two around the world is Smurfs 2, another $17 million. It's at $288 million and counting. It looks like it'll hit $300 million. Since Smurfs 2 only cost $110 million to make, that means they're tripling their budget. Practically, they're getting there, and that means there will be a Smurfs 3.
So what you're saying is that was no little movie.
That's right. And number three is Riddick, the Vin Diesel film. It grossed $16 million. It's at $53 million and counting. Not a ton yet, but it's still chugging it along. And it only cost, Riddick was not that expensive. It was surprising. What did it cost? $38 million is the reported budget. I can't imagine that includes the points that Vin Diesel's getting.
I can't imagine either. Although, you know, who knows? I mean.
Well, I think for that movie, you got to have Vin Diesel, and therefore he's going to have a piece of the movie.
Let me get this straight. For a Riddick movie, you need to have the actor who's playing Riddick.
Well, you know, I mean, you can cast new people, but I think the only reason to do it is with Vin Diesel.
Okay.
That's how I feel. At number four around the world, yet another big South Korean film. This is The Face Reader. It grossed $15 million. It's a period drama about a man whose family, his noble family, is destroyed. He wanders the country, becomes an expert in physiognomy, if I'm saying that right, or face reading. He can tell if you're lying. He can tell what you're thinking. He can tell what you want by reading your face, and he becomes part of a power struggle in the 15th century for the throne. So yet another big hit in South Korea. That country's box office is on fire. And number five is The Family. This is the mob comedy starring Robert De Niro and Michelle Pfeiffer. It grossed $14 million. Not a very good start. Some pretty poor reviews. but it only costs $30 million to make. At least that's what they're saying. Again, I bet De Niro gets some piece of that. At number six is We're the Millers, the Jennifer Aniston comedy. That costs another $14 million. It's now past the $200 million mark. At number seven is Planes, the Disney animated film. Another $13 million. That's at $138 million. Very poorly reviewed. A blotch on the reputation of Pixar, which it is not technically a film from. It's from Disney's home video division. But it costs $50 million to make, and it's tripling that. So everybody's going to be happy, I guess, at least at Disney. I think it's a loss, ultimately, because of what it does to them. But if they sell $1 billion in toys, they'll be happy.
Now, this next film that you're going to mention here, it uh-huh. just goes to show you how important the Chinese market is to some people or for some films. And here's why.
All right. White House Down. That's the Channing Tatum film, correct?
Yes.
It grossed $13 million. It's at $170 million and counting. It cost $150 million to make. So this movie is still way in the red, no matter how much money it makes in China.
That's right. All that money was made in China. Although it's in 31 territories, but a lot of that money was made in China.
You mean for this week's box office?
I believe so, yes.
Right. China is a very important. If it was only in China, it might have made $12 million and it'd still be in the top 10 or close to it. And that would be fine. But they only take out about 25% of the money, right?
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
Right. So no, it's important numbers to remember. But as far as profitability, we always have to put an asterisk by the Chinese money. We think worldwide they take back about 50% now, right?
That's about right. Yeah. On average.
We think that's about right. You know, it varies from territory to territory, but that's the rough average. But China's becoming more and more important. And that's why Hollywood needs to put more and more pressure on them to say, hey, you want our big movies? We want a bigger cut of the pie. And China can say, well, we don't care. Well, then you say, fine, then you don't get the movies.
You're having the whole conversation for them.
I am.
That's pretty cool, actually.
At number nine is Elysium, which my friend Noam saw and found disappointing. It grossed $10 million, and it's made $232 million worldwide. That's the Matt Damon sci-fi flick.
Did you just give a shout out to one of your friends in the middle of the show?
You wondered, this movie's been out in the U.S. box office for 6 weeks now, which seems like forever, doesn't it? No, that's – I'm sorry. It was
– I can't say. I think it longer than that, don't you think?
Yeah, I think it says 6 weeks.
Wow. Seems like ancient.
Yeah, well, it's made $88 million in North America. It cost $115 million to make. It's still making some money around the world. It's made another $10 million. It's about to just double its budget so far. So that's a good sign. It should hit profitability. But, you know, is it it's neither a big step forward or a step back for the director, Neil Blomkamp, the South African director. I think the promise of District 9 is yet to be fulfilled. But Hollywood has seen this guy can deliver a big movie, he can handle a big budget, and he's going to make you some money, so he'll get to make his next film. And number 10 is Percy Jackson, Sea of Monsters. It needs to make a lot of money in China if it's going to become profitable. It made another $9 million. It's at $165 million and counting. And number 11 is Lee Daniels, The Butler. Another $8 million. It's at $102 million. It passed the $100 million mark. It started to open overseas. It's in three territories. It made $2.5 million outside of North America. Hey, if a movie makes $100 million in the U.S. and you don't open it overseas, I think you're leaving money on the table. So they're starting to open it elsewhere. Let's see how well it does. At number 12, another Patrick Wilson horror film, The Conjuring. Another $7 million. That's at $270 million and counting. At number 13, a film I don't know what it is. I missed this one. Silent Witness. It grossed $6.3 million. It's in one territory. I have no idea what it is or where it's playing, but I'm going to guess South Korea.
I think, you know, the funny thing is you actually have a very good shot at being right on that.
Do you have any idea what it is?
I have no idea, but I will look it up as you continue.
Okay. At number 14, Despicable Me 2. That's at $840 million. One Direction, This Is Us, I made another $5.5 million worldwide. It's at $57 million and counting. In North America and worldwide, it is now the fourth highest grossing concert film of all time. Anyone who says that this is a disappointment because it didn't make as much as, say, the Miley Cyrus movie is an idiot. The biggest movies of all time worldwide are Michael Jackson's This Is It, $250 million. Justin Bieber, Never Say Never, $99 million. And I think his tweet about playing Robin in the next Batman movie, the Batman Superman movie, that was a joke.
He's not going to be?
Dude, Justin Bieber tweeted jokingly that he was going to play Robin in the next Batman movie.
Okay.
I think it's a joke. It was just a joke he did. He said, I'm about to make a joke. What's it called? I'm going to be about to be funny or die. And then he posted a picture of the script from Batman versus Superman or whatever you want to call that new project. and claimed that he was Robin. It was just a little hint of a joke. Anyway, and number three around the world.
You think my jokes are bad?
Well, Justin Bieber is just trying to create a little excitement. Oh, will he be Robin the Boy Wonder for Ben Affleck's Batman? The third biggest concert film of all time, of course, Hannah Montana, Miley Cyrus, $70 million, and One Direction right behind there at $57 million, far and away bigger than Jonas Brothers at $50 million, the fourth biggest grossing concert film of all time. These kids cannot be hotter. However, they could be hotter. Look back to the Beatles. They never really released a concert film. Let It Be had a small release. It was more of a documentary. A Hard Day's Night is as close as they ever came. That made $12 million. But Sperling, what should I do? What should I do with that $12 million they grossed in 1964? Well, I should adjust for inflation,
that's
right?
That's right. So that would be, oh my gosh, they're some of the richest people on the planet.
$471 million. That's how much money the Beatles made back in the 60s, if you convert it to today's dollars. So that even Michael Jackson should stand in awe of the Beatles.
Awe of them so much that he actually purchased their...
That's right. And finally, one final note. At the North American box office, I think the big news still is Instructions Not Included. That grossed another $4 million. It's a $26 million in counting. It added a couple more screens. It had sort of a big hit at the box office, dropped 48%. But this is still a very successful film.
Now, Silent Witness, I believe, is a Chinese film.
Oh, well, there you go.
So that's why it made so much money, maybe.
It opened in China.
I wonder if they'll only get 25% of the gross.
So that's it for movies at the box office around the world. But this is festival time. We have had Telluride in Toronto. I've just started to attend the New York Film Festival, where I saw a very good film today and yesterday. Two good movies in a row. So I'm very happy to start off. But we should talk about film festivals.
Well, Michael, as I stated before, this is one of my favorite shows of the year because we get to talk to Anne Thompson from IndieWire. And Anne has a charmed life. She did not make it to Cannes this year because, Anne, I believe you're working on a book, correct?
That's true.
Uh-oh. Okay.
Whoa. Are you not allowed to talk about it?
There is a book. It'll show up someday.
Okay. There's a book that Anne may or may not be able to talk about. But, you know, Anne, over the past, month, has been to Telluride, Colorado for the film festival there. And she's been to Toronto for the film festival that takes place there annually each year. There's a lot of overlap in those two festivals. And Anne is here to tell us all about the films she saw and what films we have to look forward to in the fall. So, Anne, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Will there be overlap in years to come? I hear Toronto is dropping the hammer and saying, you know what? No more world premieres at Telluride. If you want to be at Toronto, you better not go to Telluride. Is that the case? Is that happening?
It's not as simple as that. Basically, what I spoke to Cameron Bailey, and what he's saying is, you know, Telluride's always flown under the radar by trying not to use the nomenclature of world premieres and so forth. They just don't announce their festival in advance and play them when they play them. But there always used to be a kind of understanding with Venice that they would, you know, if some of the films would play first in Venice and then they would play in Telluride. This year, that there were a couple times when things played in Telluride first. And I think what Cameron Bailey is saying is, if you want a prime slot on the opening weekend of Toronto with a world premiere slot, you better not premiere in Telluride first. So people may have to make a choice. Now, three films were in Telluride: All Is Lost, The Robert Redford, Inside Llewyn Davis. What was the third one? Nebraska, that had been in Cannes and didn't go to Toronto at all. And then they're going to skip Toronto and go to New York. So there is a little bit of movement here. And I think it's a question of Telluride not getting away with as much. But people may still want to go there because it's a very well curated festival. The talent loves to go there. And there's a kind of prestige factor there, whereas Toronto is this sort of sprawling, come one, come all kind of big festival. But what you get at Toronto is you get the bigger audiences and you get more media and you get more of a sense of how something plays. And so, and almost like if it debuts in Telluride and goes to Toronto, then you get a confirmation in Toronto, like Gravity and 12 Years a Slave. They played incredibly well in Telluride. And then they really went on to play even better in Toronto.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess Telluride, Colorado, it's up in the mountains. It's a little hard to get to. And so, you know, not only does the talent and the creatives love going there, I think the press loves going there because they get to mingle with the talent and creatives so easily. Because they're just
wonderful.
They're just walking around.
You go to dinners. And I mean, I can remember sort of going to a Fox Searchlight dinner and sort of you know, a few years ago for The Descendants, I guess, yeah, The Descendants, and hanging out with George Clooney, you know, what's not to like?
Yeah.
You know, you hang out with, you know, Robert Redford and, you know, someone like this year, it was Robert Redford. Last year, it was Ben Affleck at the picnic, you know, the opening day picnic. It's great.
That's right, because Argo premiered, well, Argo played at Telluride and then went on to premiere at Toronto. And you mentioned two films that played at Telluride this year and then went on to premiere at, well, I guess Gravity.
Gravity was already at, it world premiered at Venice anyway. Yeah.
Well, but Gravity, I guess, also played at Toronto. And this is the Alfonso Cuarón, you know, as you say, the long-awaited space drama debuted to raves in Venice and moved on to Telluride in Toronto, where the upbeat reviews continue to swell. And I cannot, there's so much good buzz behind this movie. It stars Sandra Bullock and George Clooney. It's a double-hander, as they say, a two-hander, where they're stuck in space.
A double-hander is something entirely different. I have to say, I'm a little, I'm happily surprised to hear this, because I saw the trailer for Gravity in a movie theater with a regular audience, and it was so bad people actually laughed at it. It just looked ridiculous. So I'm very happy to hear that, in fact, it may be a good movie. It's getting very good reviews. Tell us about it, Anne.
It's really extraordinary. It's one of those movies like Avatar or 2001 Space Odyssey or...
Those should not be mentioned in the same breath.
Or Life of Pi. It's a space movie. It's a 3D technological wonder. If you know Alfonso Cuarón, who did Children of Men and Itu Mama Tambien, he loves movies that have long, long, long shots. And in order to accomplish these, he has like a 17-minute sequence, you know, with debris coming and hitting a space station, and Sandra Bullock is up there spinning into space, and it's sort of primal. It sort of deals with some of our deepest fears of being out of control, and it's a brilliant movie. It really is. It's a brilliant movie conceptually in terms of execution, and Sandra Bullock, I argue, will not only, she'll be a very, very strong contender for Best Actress against the likes of Kate Blanchett and Meryl Streep, but she's also, I don't think any other actress could have done this role. It had such precision required. It was almost like she's trained as a ballet dancer, and she had to be able to choreograph and deliver this role and act in a very, very precise way. I spoke to Cuarón, and he was just raving about what she was able to do.
Now, we're talking about the Academy Awards Best Actress at the Oscars, of course. Now, your Cate Blanchett would be for what film?
Blue Jasmine.
Okay, that's...
She's going into the festivals, she was the front runner, the one to sort of beat, you know, given what had been seen so far. And right now, the additions, do you want to do that? Do you want to do the whole Best Actress list?
Knock us out.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it would be, the additions would be Sandra Bullock and Meryl Streep from and Julia Roberts from August. Osage County, which played well. This is a movie. This is one of those movies that's a crowd pleaser. It's fun. It's actors acting. You know that the acting branch of the Academy will just cavil over this movie, and it's just a lot of fun, based on the Pulitzer Prize winning Tracy Letts play, and he adapted it, and John Wells directed it, and there's no question that Meryl Streep and Julia Roberts should be both considered for Best Actress in this. And then the other movie that played, and that I did not see, that my reviewer in Venice reviewed very well, was Philomena, Stephen Frears' film, and Judi Dench has made quite a splash with that, and I can't wait to see it. And she seems to be in the running as well.
I never would have thought that director Steve McQueen would be a crowd pleaser, but in fact, his film, 12 Years a Slave, based on a true story of a man kidnapped from the North and taken back to the South and put into slavery, this film won the Audience Award at Toronto, which is their top prize in a way, even though it's voted on by the audience and not a poll of critics or artists. It's the real key award, like the Sundance Award, that shows a movie that could play very well for audiences and come Oscar time.
And it has a history of predicting the Best Picture Oscar with movies like Slumdog Millionaire. So it did really well. I loved it. It's an extraordinary movie. It will be a must-see movie. It'll be a movie that changes the conversation about race in our country. It's long overdue. It took a Brit to do it. But John Ridley was the writer who adapted the memoir by Solomon Northup. And it's a true story. And that's part of its power, is that it has that ring of authenticity. And Chiwetel Ejiofor will be, I think, the actor to beat for best actor as well. And Michael Fassbender for supporting actor.
But given McQueen's track record of very austere art films, what happens here in this movie? Is this a film that will play to a wide audience? Is it sort of a tough ride, but one that they're going to want to take? Or what about it is perhaps appealing to a wider audience?
You know, you know who I would compare him to? I would compare him to Catherine Bigelow. You know, he's someone from a very strong intellectual, artistic background who's come from museum installations and shows like that. And he is eager to use the force of his intellect to reach a wider audience. And this one will do that. There's no question.
And we're talking really about Steve McQueen, who is not Steve McQueen, the actor who has passed away, but Steve McQueen, the director of Hunger and of Shame.
And the British and British visual artist.
Yes.
So yes, I agree with you. But this one is he also likes long takes, and there's some sequences, especially I'm sure you've heard there's a whipping sequence that is part of what happens with the movie is that you are immersed in this world and it's very real. That's what the strength of his filmmaking technique does, and you are forced to deal with this whipping scene. And it's like, I this may seem like a Blythe comparison, but remember at the time when Dances with Wolves came out, it was a movie that helped America to deal with its shameful relationship to Native Americans. Well, this is sort of the same thing. Our shameful relationship with slavery is being dealt with here.
Well, and just as we go through some of these films, Rush Play, this is Ron Howard's Formula One racing movie. I almost don't want to mention it because I don't necessarily know that it has any awards potential, but you kind of said, well, you know, it's Oscar prospects are less clear. Was that a polite way of saying, yeah, it's going to be a nice popcorn movie?
You know, it's actually a really good movie, and there's a great deal of artistry and skill at work, and both Chris Hemsworth and Daniel Brühl are very, very good. I could imagine Daniel Brühl, of all the aspects of the movie, I could see him getting a supporting actor nomination for his extraordinary performance as Niki Lauda, the Formula One race car driver. The movie is so entertaining and commercial, and I'm sure it's going to do really well. It depends on how the critics treat it, whether it's taken, you know, does it have enough gravitas? Is it time? You know, I don't know. It's a competitive year. That's really what it amounts to.
Well, Daniel Brühl,
it could be the
last
one standing for all we know. You know,
Daniel Brühl's a favorite actor of mine. So overall, stepping back to the film festivals you've been to and the reports you've gotten from others, you feel like this is going to be a very good fall and a good Oscar season, because it hasn't been a strong year so far for big Hollywood movies.
No, I agree. And yes, the David Poland of Movie City News asked a bunch of us who participate in the Gurus of Gold to come up with 8 front runners and 7, you know, second tier movies, like a list of 15. We did that before Toronto, and there was and 12 Years a Slave, by the way, led that list before Toronto, and it will still lead the list. So right now you definitely have 12 Years a Slave and Gravity and up at the top, ahead of everybody else. And then there are a bunch of films we haven't seen yet that are going to have to, you know, measure up. But there are 10 candidates out there. It's just a question of what comes in and what happens. But that, I had a wonderful time. I cannot tell you what a great time I had watching. I loved this movie, Trax, which I don't even know whether it's going to come out this year, that Mia Wasikowska was in, that Weinstein picked up. You know, that's one of my favorites. I loved the Nicole Hall of Center movie Enough Said, which I think is one of the best films of the year, but we'll see. You know, James Gandolfini gives a great performance in it.
And it's
is
his last
lead
it's his
or
last
supporting, I don't know.
Yeah. It's his last performance, if I'm not
it
mistaken.
It is. Yeah. It is indeed. And it's heartbreaking. It's so good.
And I guess you don't think maybe The Fifth Estate, which is the WikiLeaks movie from Disney and DreamWorks, Bill Condon directed it, that's not going to necessarily be making a whole bunch of people's lists.
No, and part of the reason for that is that it's one of those brainy, ambitious, try to wrap your brain around something that simply is probably intractable for a reasonably commercial movie. It's a big, expensive movie, but and I enjoyed it, but and Daniel Brühl is very good in it. So is Benedict Cumberbatch. But I don't think, no, you're right. Nothing's going to happen with that one. I bet it doesn't do well at the box office, unfortunately.
Well, and it seemed, at least from afar, from, say, I don't know, all the way back to Los Angeles, it seemed like a great year both at Telluride and Toronto, as Michael was mentioning, so much so that there were 21 sales to major distributors, major U.S. distributors, that is. And, of course, Weinstein was just, he went there with pockets full of cash.
And he bought a lot of things.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, he really went nuts.
Yeah.
He had 7 movies there, and he bought more movies.
Yes. Can a Song Save Your Life, to me, is one of the films that seems most promising. They spent $7 million for U.S. rights in a bidding war.
Yeah, I mean, the range of responses to that is, on the one hand, you know, love, 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 you know, made me cry, made me laugh, you know, great music. On the other, because this is from John Carney, who did Once. And on the other, treacly, sweet, you know, emotional. So it some people, it was a little too, you know, kind of manipulative for them. But I didn't see it, so I'm looking forward to it.
It was emotional. I won't stand for that.
Some people are like that. I know. I loved Once, so we'll see. We'll have to wait and see.
How was Toronto run as a festival? How was it this year? I know the first day, I think there were some growing pains. There was some confusion. Did it sort itself out? Was it the typically well-run festival, or how did it go?
They're very, very organized, and they do run a very strong festival. There was some, it did feel as if, especially with the press and industry screenings, there was such congestion and then so many people in the theater that it got a little out of hand, but that was during the peak first 4 days or so, and then it calmed down and it was fine.
And there was a bit about a blogger calling 911 about somebody using a cell phone in one of the screenings, potentially to pirate, which in the end it wasn't to pirate a film. And that caused a lot of kerfuffle on the internet. Was it as much of a thing up there as well?
No, I mean, people complained because I was rather shocked at how many people in the press and industry screenings were just routinely, you know, hanging out with their phones. I don't think it was the press, by the way, that was doing that. I think it was the industry people. So I think that guy, Alex Billington, you know, overreacted a bit. But and I think that event got more attention, perhaps, than it warranted. But one could ask. I asked Cameron Bailey, and he was sort of saying, well, you know, we tell them not to use their phones, you know, what else can we do?
Send people down the aisles and say, turn off your phone.
it's unfortunate.
Well, two last things. Blue is the Warmest Color is one of my favorite films of the year. It won the Palme d'Or in Cannes for both the director and the two stars, one of whose name I will not even try and pronounce, Adele XR Chapulu, or I can't pronounce her last name. Lia Seydoux is the other actress. In Cannes, it was known as the three-hour lesbian movie. It won the festival. It went on to Telluride in Toronto, but you're saying that it will not be nominated for Best Foreign Language Film because it's going to open after October 1st in France.
Correct. And I asked the people about that. It seemed like a strange decision for them to make. They basically said this was a good, they had a good commercial slot for the movie. They didn't want to change it because those are hard to come by. They had made that decision long before Cannes, before they knew that they were going to do as well as they did at Cannes. And they didn't think that it would be submitted by France anyway. And then they didn't think it would be the kind of movie that the Oscar voters would go for. And they may be right about that, by the way. I love the movie too. I think it's great. I'm curious to see how Sundance Selects, IFC, and Sundance Selects do in terms of pushing Adele, I think, Escarpopoulos, into the running. You know what, Sperling, if we figured out Convention A. Wallace, we can manage Adele Escarpopoulos too.
That's true. But I'm gonna let the Academy figure it out first and then say it a couple times, and that way I can just copy what they say. Now, you know, in closing, I wanted to get your take on this because you were up in Toronto when this occurred. What this big shakeup at Universal Pictures, where Adam Fogelson and Donna Langley, who were running the division over there at Universal together, all of a sudden, Adam Fogelson and Donna Langley and Ron Meyer being the chairman of Universal, they head back from the premiere of Rush, and Adam Fogelson is out, Donna Langley is promoted, and so is Ron Meyer. I mean, it shocked me. Did it shock as many people in Toronto?
It shocked everybody. And the reason it shocked everybody is that everybody in Hollywood follows certain rules. And most of those rules include, and I can explain why this doesn't apply, but it includes if you have a good year and you win the summer and, you know, all the stories are very upbeat about how well your studio is doing, usually you don't get sacked. So that's why everybody was so shocked, because on the surface of things, it looked like Adam Fogelson and Donna Langley together were doing a very, very good job. And I would argue that he's a smart guy and he knows what he's doing. And I thought he was actually pulled the studio out from where it had been in somewhat of disarray. Ron Meyer was supposedly being kicked upstairs, or he was on the verge of retirement or something.
Which he's wanted to retire for some time. He has not made any bones.
He's not leaving yet because they're bringing in this new guy, Jeff Schell, who is the heir apparent, you know, Steve Burke, the head of Comcast, which owns NBC now, basically doesn't want, he wants his guy. He wants his guy. He made him go off to London for a while. And this guy really wanted to come back. And so he's the one who's going to run the studio now. And they're smart to hang on to Donna because they need consistency on the production side. They're smart to hang on to Ron because he'll be able to teach this guy yet again the ropes.
It seems like Ron Meyer's there more as a coach for all of the people that Universal.
Mentor.
Yeah. And he has to introduce this new person, Jeff Schell, as the head of Universal Pictures to the industry because he has no industry experience. Sounds a lot like Warner Brothers.
Well,
he has no motion picture experience.
Slightly different. In the case of Warner Brothers, Kevin Tsujihara is coming up from the digital side, the home video side. He's obviously a studio veteran. And, when I met him for the first time at Comic-Con, he said to me, well, you know, I had DC, you know, answering to me, you know. So he's had a lot of exposure. He's been around and he has the guy who was right under Jeff Robinoff, who's knows production. He has the marketing person. There are people behind him who know what they're doing. The question is whether he's going to bring in anyone new. I imagine Jeff Robinoff is going to go help Jim Giannopoulos do his thing without Tom Rothman over at Fox. That's probably what will happen. But this is different. This is more like Rich Ross coming into Disney or Gail Berman from television coming over to Paramount, where they really didn't know movies at all.
And both failed.
Indeed.
And what do you see happening here?
Well, this guy is supposedly very smart. He has learned a lot about the studio business in the last couple of years, and he does have Ron Meyer and Donna Langley to help him. So what happened with Berman and with Rich Ross was that they were just handed the reins and said, you know, go for it. We want to change everything. And that was sort of a mistake.
Right.
I don't think that's what's going on at Universal. I think they're looking for some continuity there.
And you're saying that the rules didn't apply this time because even though Adam Fogelson, who is now out of a job, even though, you know, he helped with Donna Langley pull the studio into a more successful spin, you know what? He just wasn't a Comcast guy.
That's the problem. You had a new owner. This is a question of how well did Adam Fogelson manage up inside the organization?
Apparently, clearly,
he did not succeed at winning over the people he needed to win over. And he may not have bet that Ron Meyer was going to continue to succeed there. So, he may have done absolutely nothing wrong whatsoever, and there simply wasn't a space for him, and they wanted Jeff Schell to be in that space.
Right. Well, certainly whether it's this news about Universal Pictures or your time at Toronto and Telluride, I appreciate, and I'm speaking for Michael here, but we appreciate you taking the time out to join us and tell us all about the films that we have to look forward to this fall. It seems like we're going to be spending a lot of time in movie theaters.
Thank God.
Indeed.
Meanwhile, Robert Towne is going to go work for Mad Men. That tells you something about our industry right there.
Robert Towne. Wow.
He's writing a script for them?
He's going to be in the writing room on Mad Men.
For their final two seasons, yeah, which is now spread out over 2 years.
That's right.
Can you write the line, "Forget it, Don. It's Madison Avenue."
You should see all the rejoinders. He's my brother. He's my father, Don Draper.
Right.
You know, they're already having a blast.
Wow. So from Chinatown to Madison. Yeah, that's a move. That's for sure.
All right. Thanks, guys. It was fun.
Thank you.
Thanks
Talk
a lot.
To you soon.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay. So what is Anne's book about? We don't know. I'm going to guess it's about women in Hollywood.
Wait a second. That's what you got out of that conversation? Okay.
No, well, she didn't say it. She didn't say anything.
Okay.
So it's a secret. I don't know what her book's about. I'm just trying to guess. What would she be writing about? A Hollywood book, I assume.
Yes.
We've had the rise of the indies and all that. How about women in Hollywood?
The rise of big blockbuster movies that don't do well.
We've already covered that.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess what else should we cover in movies? You know, we really should have asked Anne about this Disney thing, this stunt, as I'd like to call it, that they're pulling with the Little Mermaid.
Right. This is one of the dumber ideas I've heard about.
So there's something called second screen and just
no, there isn't.
Well, okay.
There's something Disney wants you to know about called second screen. If you get a DVD or Blu-ray from them, every once in a while they'll have some extra features that you can play along with on your tablet. So the idea is you call up second screen because God forbid you actually just watch a movie. They want you to have your phone or your tablet in front of you as well. You start the movie, you start the app on your tablet usually, and then you play along and you do things and they do stuff like play games or it's interactive. And instead of just watching the movie, you get to do several other things at the same time. I hate it. I think it's moronic. I think the movie should be enjoyed as the movie, and then you do other things separately. But well, there you go. They've had this in home video for a while now.
And on television. And on television. In all fairness, there's a few television shows that do this.
And that's pretty dumb. Our Twitter feed while you watch our show.
I get a daily email about all these second screen news, and I don't use second screen. I understand the concept that a lot of people are answering email or reading email or doing something else while they're watching
TV.
This
is about something to distract you from the thing they want you to watch.
Right.
Of course, people do other things. They go to the fridge. They get a drink. They answer the phone. They pause the show. This is, you're watching our movie. Please also stare at your iPad or Nook or whatever it is and do something else.
Right. Well, and in this case,
if you're going to be distracted, we want to be the ones to distract you. So what is Disney doing? They're taking this wonderful idea and putting it in the movie theaters.
Right. They're saying we not only want to distract the people who wish to be distracted, but we'd like to distract everybody else who shows up for the movie.
Right. So they're showing The Little Mermaid in theaters. It's just a small release, about 12 locations around the country.
Right.
It's just to get a little press before the movie comes out on Blu-ray. It'll be a lovely new Blu-ray edition of The Little Mermaid, a classic film. We've all seen it. It's worth seeing again. But they're going to have the second screen experience taking place in the movie theaters. They're encouraging people in those 12 locations to bring their tablet to the movie theater, start up an app, and do all the stuff that you do while you're not watching the movie. So they're encouraging people to bring tablets to a movie theater, turn them on, and use them.
Right, and
that's
play games.
That's a horrifically bad idea.
And here are all these, you know, it's hard enough to find, you know, the people who are pirating movies these days. Now you're actually saying, look, could you please bring that device that has a camera on the other end of it, an HD camera, no less, and can you please hold it up and point it at the screen while you're playing around with the app that we made for you?
It's just a dumb, dumb idea for what it teaches kids about how they should behave in a movie theater. It's dumb for teaching them about, gee, you're going to be so bored even watching a great film like The Little Mermaid that we have to give you other stuff to do so you don't get ADD on us. So it's just, I hate it in every possible way. I think it's a big whoop because it doesn't really matter. It's only a few screens. No one's going to really pay attention. But boy, is it dumb.
Okay, well, it is, you know, what it is doing actually is using, and I'm not necessarily disagreeing with you, by the way, I'm just pointing out that there is some technology behind that, so that—
Who cares?
You'll see where I'm going with this. You know, I always have a reason for why I'm talking about something. Mm-hmm. So now this technology has to stay in sync, it has to keep the second screen app in sync with what's on screen. And the technology that's doing that is some special technology, I think, being made out of the UK that is going to be more used for the ads that are being shown before movies in theaters down the line. But that's rather inventive and ingenious, and that's brand new technology. And somebody else that created a whole bunch of new technology over the space.
Wait a second. I'm sorry, but isn't this just a matter of starting at the same time? It's like playing the Pink Floyd Dark Side of the Moon album when you're watching The Wizard of Oz. All as long as you start at the same time, it'll be in sync. It doesn't have to have any super extra length. You know how long the movie is. You know what scenes are going to be showing on the screen. So you just have your app play whatever is appropriate for that scene in the movie. You have a controlled thing there. The movie's 84 minutes long or whatever it is. You know at minute 12, you want to have this thing happen on the app. What's the big deal?
And the
you don't
person
have to
who
have
comes
a constant
in late?
Wi-Fi connection. You don't have to have anything. You just play the game along.
And the person who comes in late?
What do you mean the person who comes in late?
The person who comes in a minute late and then starts a minute late.
And you're out of sync.
Exactly. So that's why this technology helps keep things in sync.
No, but that doesn't work. You're telling me if I show up halfway through the movie and start the app, they will start the app at minute 34. Big deal.
Okay,
so it starts at minute 34. They know when the movie's playing, right? They know the movie's playing at noon. So if you show up at 12:34 and start the app at 12:34, they know you're at the 34th minute of the movie. What's the big deal? How complicated can that be? They may do it in a more complicated way, but that's all you really have to do. Am I wrong?
No, that's one way of doing it.
The simple way. So who else is doing something much smarter? Tell me something that sounds better.
Well, certainly it's something that sounds better. Unfortunately, he is no longer doing it. Dr. Ray Dolby of Dolby Laboratories, the founder and basically Dolby Laboratories and digital surround sound. He was one of the pioneers in audio and reducing tape hiss and the like. He passed away at the age of 80 over the past week. And I was interested in the fact that the way they kind of eulogized Dr. Dolby, and he was, let's face it, an inventor, very...
Let's face it? Well, make it sound like we're having to, you know... square off to someone. Well, let's face it, he was
a pioneer. I mean, he was
of course
his work was groundbreaking. Were there others that were doing
it was certainly commercially successful. He's the one that made it a big business because you had Dolby on your stereos, you had Dolby in movie theaters. That was the mark of quality for many years until THX came along.
That's correct. And THX is actually more of a certification program than a technology.
That's right.
But that's a whole other story. But you know, I wrote a piece for Celluloid Junkie that kind of asked the question that because DCI, the Digital Cinema Initiatives, and this is a digital cinema requirements document and test that was written by the studios, written by seven studios, MGM is the seventh one, and they crafted it in such a way that, I'm sorry?
MGM is the seventh one? What does that mean? Who cares? What?
Well, because there's six studios, okay?
Oh, okay.
And the seventh one is, there's seven studios in DCI, and MGM is the seventh one, even though they're not really a studio.
Tell it to the Hobbit.
Okay, well, yeah. If I'm not mistaken, Warner Brothers had to come in and actually pay for that. So I think you
so
just proved my point.
So the studios came together and said, we want to set some standards for audio systems in movie theaters.
Well, a whole bunch of technology, not just mm-hmm. Audio, but packaging and image quality and a whole bevy of standards, which they specifically said should be non-proprietary. They actively wanted to stop paying for the technologies that Dolby and DTS and others were creating and making them pay for.
And what's wrong with that? The one problem with the book industry is that they don't have open standards, that if you buy a book for the Amazon Kindle, you can't easily put it on your Nook. And so if you have a different audio system standard for all your movie theaters in the country, wouldn't it be a problem if, you know, you created a movie track for one system and then found out that theater had another system?
Yes, and that was what caused the DTS Dolby audio format wars of the 90s. And that was a big, big dilemma. They didn't want that again. But more directly, they didn't want to have to pay. They didn't want to have to license the technology. And I get that. And it's one thing, by the way, there is an open standard for ebooks. It's EPUB. The fact that Amazon...
They haven't adopted it, though. The industry has not adopted it.
Well, you...
There is a standard that people can use, but it does not work across all platforms, so people aren't using it.
Right.
So if you buy a book via Amazon, it ain't going to work with others. It's not EPUB.
Right, correct. It's Mubi.
There's Unix. That doesn't mean everybody uses it. You know, whatever.
What? Yes.
All right. So there's this audio. You don't like that it's open source audio because you think it will crush innovation. Somebody like Dolby, who comes along with a great sound system idea or an audio idea, doesn't have the chance, you think, to make money off of it because there's this open source standard. And therefore, they won't be able to get residuals. And therefore, there will be no incentive for them to do the work.
Correct. Yes. And I'm not saying that it's just audio. And I'm not saying, by the way, that open sourcing something or open standards are a bad thing.
It sounds like it.
No, I'm saying that when it's a natural progression, when, for instance, certain standards become standards because they're industry standards and not just standards that are written, that's more natural. Here, the industry is actually mandating around proprietary technology. They're trying to get away from it by falsely putting in these safeguards so that they don't have to pay. I guess the example I used is cassette tapes. There was a natural end to cassette tapes, just like there's a natural end to CDs. Nobody came in and mandated that no more CDs and tried to force the issue. Here they're coming in and saying no more digital surround sound that's compressed. It has to be all uncompressed. Well, quite honestly, that probably was going to happen anyway. So you didn't really need to mandate it, but they really wanted to make sure that everybody knew no proprietary technologies are going to be allowed in digital cinema, which is, by the way, the reason that you see all of the research and technology being pushed toward 3D, in which proprietary technology is allowed.
But if there's an open source standard, can't somebody create something really good that works within those standards and that all movies will play on and yet be superior and that people will want to adopt and use and pay for?
Yeah, look at MySQL So
what's the problem?
This is just a much smaller industry. There's 7 buyers. You know, there's a bunch of exhibitors that can pay. It's a much smaller industry. So if it's, you know, you pretty much need proprietary technology. If it's going to be a big advance, you need proprietary technology, at least for a short period of time, to recoup your research and development cost.
All right. You've lost me. So open source is good, except here it's bad because there aren't that many customers.
Open source
is always
good. And
they're not using open source to encourage openness. They're using it to shut the door on paying money to Dolby.
Well, it's twofold.
Who are they screwing over? Well, what's the company they're screwing over?
Let's see. DTS is no longer in the business of motion picture audio, at least not on a theatrical level. And Dolby is struggling as well with Atmos. They're doing much better than, say, Barco is doing with Oro 11.1. But they're having to, like, put all
So who is doing well? What's the big audio company right now?
Well, Dolby in home. Dolby and DTS.
No. We're talking about movie theaters.
Well, there is no audio company that's really doing that well except for Dolby and Barco on their experimental, you know, extended surround sound.
So who are they screwing over? Who are they trying to avoid paying? If they're not paying anybody a lot of money, what payments are they trying to avoid?
Dolby and DTS. They're not paying them
anymore.
They
weren't doing well. I'm confused. I'm just confused.
Dolby and DTS are no longer being paid a film licensing fee for the use of their technology by the studios.
But you just said they're not doing well. They're pretty much out of the industry anyway.
Because the studio stopped paying them.
When? When were the standards instituted? You're just mentioning it now.
2005, 2006.
Oh, my God. You're talking to me about something that went into place 8 years ago?
Yes, but was only
You could have clarified that. It just happened to be mentioned in the obit of Dolby.
It's in my obit.
Right. Oh, dear God. So this happened 8 years ago. Oh.
Yes, but of course, digital cinema wasn't adopted until 2009 in earnest. Uh-huh. So really, we're talking about 4 years ago.
It was adopted. The standards were set 8 years ago.
Yes, they were.
Okay.
And they continue to be set, and they continue to change.
All right. And you think it was all a nefarious plot to screw over Dolby and DTS, and it worked?
Not just Dolby and DTS, but anybody with proprietary technology.
Okay. So studios using crappy sound, or what are they doing? How are they getting away
with it? No, they're using uncompressed sound, which is why I'm saying, like, the fact that they had to mandate it means that they are trying to say, we don't want to pay for proprietary technology.
This is 8 years ago they did this, and it worked.
So basically what you're saying is we're going to write standards 8 years ago, and all of a sudden everything is supposed to work all of a sudden because 8 years ago somebody wrote standards, and that means all the technology was going to be ready eight years ago. It's not the way it works.
You buried the lead that this happened 8 years ago. I thought this was something that happened this week or something.
No, Ray Dolby passed away this week.
I understand that, but you were mentioning these new standards. I didn't realize they weren't new. That's why I'm so confused. I was trying to figure out, well, who's being affected? What's going to happen? Oh, well, it happened almost a decade ago.
Now, there is some good news with open
standards.
So there's
no good audio? I don't understand. I don't go to the theater and hear bad audio. That's the one good thing that there is. The picture may be questionable, But I don't hear bad audio anywhere.
That's because uncompressed audio is now being used.
And what's the problem with that?
Nothing.
Why is that not good?
That is good. And it naturally occurred.
Sorry that your company got outgraded by, you know, outdated by new technology.
That happens. That absolutely happens.
So that doesn't sound nefarious to me.
I'm not saying anything is nefarious. What I'm suggesting or proposing or my hypothesis is, if you actually go out and actively try and work around proprietary technology as an industry, inventors will stop coming to your industry. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying. That's really the crux.
But it sounds like were they outmoded by the new rules, open source rules, or were they outmoded by technology that made what they did unimportant anymore? They had the best darn cassette players, but we don't need cassette players anymore. What happened?
It's a little bit of both. Compressed audio was probably not needed anymore because with digital cinema. It probably would have gone by the wayside anyway.
Uh-huh.
But then they kind of forced the issue by not mandating. Now, that said, it makes digital cinema, all the equipment is supposed to be interoperable so that you can master and duplicate your content
which is
once.
Why open source is good.
That is one of the benefits. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fine line is what I'm saying. You know, I get the sense, though, that because this was 8 years ago, you feel like, well, not a big deal.
Exactly.
Okay.
Well, it also sounds like it was the right choice at the time.
It was definitely...
That you wanted to move towards uncompressed audio. You want to move towards a standard where everybody can master anything to the same open standard so that you're not limited in what choice you make as far as remastering or doing this or that or the other thing, because you know what ultimate standards every single theater will use, and therefore you can innovate as you choose and be confident that you'll all be able to play on the same playback system.
Right, and it's kind of complicated because there's an existing install base, and how do you, you know, it's, you know.
Well, that was all changing, though. 8 years ago, they knew.
Precisely.
They could see the future was digital, so they were planning for the future. Sounds like they did the right thing.
Well, they wanted to nip in the bud any proprietary, you know, anybody installing anything that they would have to pay for down the line, so. Huh. But, you know, in any case, it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment, where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story is about X Factor. The fall TV season is about to kick into high gear as the summer ends, and some new shows like Sleepy Hollow get a jump on the competition. NBC had some bad news with its high-concept game show. Ryan Seacrest was the host of the extravaganza being shot live in New York City near 42nd Street. Unfortunately, the game was so confusing it took half the show to explain all the variables. Viewers never bothered to tune in. Even worse was the return of the X Factor, with two new judges joining Simon Cowell and Demi Lovato. The season opener was down substantially, from last year, and while the numbers haven't tumbled further, it's got to be crushing, you know, a huge disappointment for a series once expected to challenge American Idol, just as it has in some countries around the world, like I think the UK.
So many countries around the world. It's a big show almost everywhere except the US.
Ah, okay, well, is it a big deal or is it a big whoop?
It's a big deal. I mean, this is the third season. It's collapsed another 20-25% in the ratings, and it was up against nothing. So that's a really bad sign for the rest of the season. It's going to have some serious competition in the weeks to come. This was a show that they invested a lot of money in that's supposed to be a big player. So for the X Factor, this is a very bad sign. It's a big whoop for Million Second Quiz, the Ryan Seacrest show, because it was a summer series. I'm sure it was expensive to mount, but it was the right sort of kind of programming, the right sort of thing to take a chance on. Maybe they'd catch lightning in a bottle, like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire or The Weakest Link. It didn't work. It's all right.
Well, they had million in the title, so they thought maybe, just maybe.
Exactly. It was just very complicated. I was walking to a theater. I'm like, what is that noise? I heard this roar of a crowd. I'm like, what is that? And I saw these lights, you know, Klieg lights, skylights. What do they call them?
Klieg lights.
Klieg lights. Yeah, yeah. The big things going up into the sky. I'm like, what is? And then I realized, oh my God, it's the set for Million Second Quiz. But there you go. Nice, easy questions. But the game setup was so complicated. I turned off after about 10 minutes.
Well, now, J.K. Rowling, you might know her from, you know, well, writing a few books. She's penning a new screenplay set in the world of Harry Potter. No, it's not strictly a sequel or prequel to Harry Potter, but J.K. Rowling is returning to that world when she writes her very first screenplay. She's never written a screenplay before. It's a spinoff to the slight but playful book she wrote called Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. So that's kind of where it's this takeoff on that. It's going to take place 70 years before Harry Potter's story even begins. It's going to start in New York City, and it's the story of that book's author, Newt Scamander, and I hope I pronounced that right. He's a member of the Department for the Regulation and Control of Magical Creatures, which I believe, Michael, your brother works for, if I'm not
mistaken. That's right.
Yes. That's right. Rowling is writing the screenplay, and Warner Brothers has modest, restrained plans for the film, including video games, theme park rides, and a huge multi-billion dollar franchise. You know, things like that, the like. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a very big deal for Warner Brothers. And of course, it's not the first time she's used a pseudonym, we realize. You know, she did it here because the book is technically by Scamander, whereas her new mystery novel is also technically by another man. So she's continuing that tradition. She's diving into screenplays for the first time. She gets to play in that world again. It's very hard to walk away from a world you've created. You see this time and again in fantasy and sci-fi when you put a lot of effort into creating a fantasy world or a sci-fi future with all sorts of rules and regulations and a society. It's very hard to just do a few books and then step away. You're just drawn back into that world. And this is a good way to do that for her without sullying the reputation of Harry Potter. So I think it makes sense. It'll be fun to see how it works out. And, you know, Warner Brothers certainly has their fingers tied that this will be a big, big franchise.
True. Now, this next story is about Miley Cyrus, because apparently no one told Miley Cyrus that her raunchy dancing on MTV's Video Music Awards, we talked
shame
about.
On her, shame
yeah.
on her.
Yeah, nobody told her, though, that it had ended her career. Somebody should have, you know, tapped her on the shoulder and said, I'm sorry, but you're over. You're done. Instead, she released a new video for the song Wrecking Ball, and set which went on to set all these records. First, it scored 19.3 million views in one day. Then it was the fastest video in history to hit 100 million viewers. Apparently, even bad news is really good publicity for Miley Cyrus. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop. I mean, you know,
have you seen the video? She's like stark raven naked in it.
She wants to be an adult. I am an adult. I am an adult. That's what she's saying.
She looks like an adult. I'll tell you that much.
She beat a record set like 2 weeks earlier by One Direction for their new song, Best Song Ever. You know, it'll be beaten a few weeks later by some other sensation. But, you know, it's a wildly popular video. We'll see how it translates onto the charts. But it's not a big deal. But, you know, I never would have thought her career was over because of the MTV Video Music Awards. That was just, hey, you know, attention is attention. So there you go. Unless you're not paying attention, you should know that that was not the end of Miley Cyrus.
Okay, well, this next story, we probably should have come after the last story, which is, you know, about another spinoff. The Walking Dead is the hottest show on TV, and by some standards, the most watched drama, period. Football may still be a little bigger, but only zombies watch that mindless violence anyway. Anyway, when a show is this big, a spinoff is almost, well, it's inevitable. And so, it's happening. The comic book creator Robert Kirkman is really psyched about the freedom of creating a show in the Walking Dead universe that isn't constrained by the stories he's, you know, already written. God, sticking to the book is such a big pain in the neck. AMC is just excited, just, you know, they're just as excited to see its biggest hit spinoff, a new series, which they hope will be an even bigger hit. And the extras, who already know how to stumble around like zombies, they're happiest of all. They're looking at health insurance for once. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop until we find out what the premise is and see if it's a good show. I mean, of course they want to do a spinoff. They're doing a spinoff of Breaking Bad, which is bizarre enough as far as I'm concerned. I guess why not? But, you know, I'm not hopeful for it. This is a really terrific show. My biggest fear is that you've got a great show. You've been doing it for 4 years. It keeps getting better and better. Focus on this show. At least Breaking Bad waited till the series was over before trying to spin off the lawyer Saul, I should say. Spin him off into his own series. I hate when people have a really big show, a really great break, and then they confuse themselves and waste their energies by trying to do spinoffs. You're lucky enough to have a great show. You have the chance to make it one of the best shows of all time. Keep making it better and better. Why distract yourself with a spinoff that nobody is waiting for?
I'm looking forward to the spinoff of Mad Men.
Yeah, I thought that was a stupid story. There was a story in Adweek, like today, saying five characters that should spin off from Mad Men. It was stupid.
I thought there was a spinoff called Sane Women.
All right, there we go.
Come on.
Keep going.
I'm in town all week, ladies and gentlemen. The Booker Prize. You might recall that this is the little award they give out to, you know, it's geared towards British writers in the UK and around the world in the British Commonwealth, including, by the way, former members of the empire like Australia and Canada. So authors from those territories can, or countries, and participate. It's easily the most influential book prize in the world and inevitably leads to a significant jump in sales. The Pulitzers and Nobels are lovely, of course. Everybody likes those, but they don't goose sales like the Booker. But the rumor is that this week they will be announcing a rules change that makes the Booker open to any novel published in the English language. During the qualifying 12 months, that is. Opening the prize up, this is, you know, Michael, you know better than anybody, this will open the prize up to all these young upstarts in America, as well as anyone in the world, frankly. One insider says that the people behind the award felt excluding writers from America was anachronistic. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal in a bad sense, because I think it's a stupid move. I don't think anybody, the Booker is one of the most recognized awards in the world. Why did you suddenly think, oh gosh, we better let American writers take part or we won't be important anymore? I don't think it was anachronistic at all. It has a very large purview of a lot of English-speaking writers. So I think they're spoiling the specialness of this award and what it means and how it's tracked the British novel over the years, and it's spread out to the colonies. I think it unnecessarily gives another platform for American writers who already have, like, the American Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize every year, which is not open to foreigners, by the way. They're not open to novels written in English from anywhere else in the world. Those are strictly for Americans. So I don't get it. There's also a technical issue of getting the books and find out what's available and reading them. You know, they already have a huge pile of books to read. Trying to now take in all of American books as well creates a much bigger problem as far as figuring out what's out there and what's good.
Especially if they're not open source.
But what I think, however, is that it's an interesting way that we have predicted that book rights will go. We've said book rights don't make any sense territory by territory.
Yeah,
What's the point of saying, you know, I've got a book for the U.S., you've got it for Canada, he's got it for England, he's got it for Australia. It doesn't make any sense, especially with the internet. Book rights have to go by language. You should have French worldwide rights to a novel. You should have English worldwide rights to a novel.
So you're saying a book, which is a language art, should revolve around language.
Yeah, that's what. Well, territorially, it doesn't make any sense now that you can release a book worldwide digitally so easily. So we think that's what will happen with book rights. Instead of buying it by territory, you buy it by language. And that's what's happening here in a way about awards.
Hey, you know, Michael, the Emmy Awards are this Sunday, but they've already handed out some of the less visible categories. They've handed out the Creative Arts Emmys is what they're called. Those are for tech categories, HBO's...
And other awards, like guest supporting actor in a movie, that sort of thing.
All the awards they don't want on television, basically.
Well, I wouldn't say that because they really messed up by not having one of them handed out the night of the Emmys. But keep going.
Right. HBO's Behind the Candelabra movie and Boardwalk Empire TV series were big winners, with the Liberace biopic getting 8 statuettes and the Mob Story 4. South Park won the Best Animated Program for the 4th time.
Yay!
Yes, that's thanks to an episode that involved Cartman accepting he was obese and a satire of Honey Boo Boo.
It was hilarious. My favorite episode of the year.
That was a very good episode, actually.
Yeah.
But really the most touching moment, and by the way, these will be on, like, I think FXX, you know, a cable network for a cable network. Mm-hmm. The most touching moment came when the legendary Bob Newhart finally won his first Emmy after decades of work on 2 hit shows and numerous guest spots. He snagged it for his turn on The Big Bang Theory. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
A big deal. I can't believe they didn't save that category for the big night. I mean, you just felt it was his year. It was a really visible guest spot on one of the hottest sitcoms around, one of the biggest, most popular shows. Everybody knew he was overdue. They blew it. They blew it.
But you know what? If he doesn't win, then, you know, you have to go explain to the best supporting actress and a, you know, guest actress, well, we thought he was going to win and he didn't. And that's why we didn't
tough
have
noogies. Anyway, if you're wondering if Mad Men will score another Emmy next season because it's, you know, because it's in its final year, well, you'll have to keep waiting because as we teased at the top of the show, AMC announced that the final season of the show, they're going to break up over 2 years, just like they did with Breaking Bad, because they felt like that gave the show more creative time and they could just squeeze it out for more publicity and attention. So the Mad Men finale will now take place not in the spring of 2014, but the spring of 2015. So you get 7 episodes in the spring coming up and then another 7 episodes in the spring of 2015. So that's the plan for Mad Men.
Plus, they want to see what Robert Towne has to come up with.
That's right. Why do you think Robert Towne should be in your writer's room is beyond me.
Well, Netflix is back on top, at least as far as investors are concerned. The company's stock was at $306 back in 2011 when they announced they would be splitting up their service and forcing customers to choose either physical DVDs or online streaming. You might recall that, Michael. We covered it back then. Those that wanted both would have to pay, well, double. Netflix was also going to rename the physical DVD service to distinguish it from what they saw as their future, which was streaming. The whole thing was a disaster, at least PR-wise, and they soon changed course. Or did they? The business was still split up, with customers being forced to choose either physical DVDs or streaming. Those wanting both still had to pay more. Netflix continued to expand and see streaming as the future both in the US and around the world. They also started creating original content to an even greater degree. The only real change they made was to keep the name Netflix for every single division. And now their stock is at an all-time high. So there, stick it. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, so there for us. I think it's a big deal because I think at the time we said people are overreacting. It's a smart decision. It made sense. They never really changed their minds about it. They just kept their heads down. So, oh, we're so sorry. We're so sorry. How dare we have done this? We'll keep the name Netflix. That was a dumb thing to get rid of the name. They're all the value. But as far as everything that they did, they did it. They stuck to it because it was smart. It made sense. It was the future. And I think at the time we said that there was no reason for the stock to be tumbling the way it was. And now it's finally come back. By the way, and of course, if you go to Netflix, you can stream or you can perhaps get a DVD of some old TV shows like The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and The Outer Limits. And that's the last time, back in the early 60s, that's the last time Robert Towne wrote a TV episode or anything for television. And this is a guy who does not work fast. So again, why is he in the room for Mad Men? I don't get it.
He might come up with one good line, like, forget it, Jake, it's Chinatown.
There you go. It's $100,000.
Exactly. Producer Jerry, well, you know who could really use him, actually?
Yeah, no, he takes forever.
Well, what's the difference? They're not going to shoot this movie now. So producer Jerry Bruckheimer is still, you know, probably, you know, I don't know, what's the correct word? Reeling, perhaps, from the financial debacle that was The Lone Ranger. Could have used Robert Towne on that one, too. Now his reputation is taking another hit as he announces that the next Pirates of the Caribbean movie has been pushed back from its scheduled release date of summer 2015. Now they plan for the summer of 2016. Bruckheimer said the delay was due to script issues of all things. Johnny Depp said, wait, these movies have scripts? Get me my assistant. Get my assistant on the line.
No? A terrible Johnny Depp.
Well, then, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop. It's the right thing to do. You're not ready. You wait. You know, they announced these movies years in advance. So changing the release date should not be a big kerfuffle. Nobody should think, oh, it's troubled or whatever. Hey, you're not ready with a decent script. These are big monsters that take a while to get going. And once the train leaves the station, you can't stop it. So they're right to make the delay announcement now.
Plus, Robert Towne is no longer available until after the Mad Men season. You got to wait for him.
It's the Caribbean. Yeah. Anyway, yeah,
in any case, here's a mystery. The Agatha Christie estate announced what they proudly touted as their first new Christie title in 38 years. There might be a reason why they haven't had a new book in a while.
She's dead.
Yes. Is it an undiscovered manuscript, maybe? Some juvenilia?
Juvenilia.
Some juvenilia dusted off and printed against her wishes? Was it Professor Plum in the library with the candlestick? No, it's best-selling author Sophie Hannah. Never trust somebody with two first names, by the way. She's been hired to write a brand new Poirot mystery, and the title will come out in the fall of 2014. Not just the title, all the pages that follow it, too. Someone was going into the public domain just about that time. Interesting. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. Every estate seems to do this. They realize that eventually they're going to lose control of their famed iconic author. Better for them to get out ahead of everybody else and have authorized sequels that will happen and try and do it with the best quality possible. And of course, they make more money. So it was bound to happen. But I feel very bad for actor David Suchet, if I'm saying his name right. He's been playing Poirot on television for like 25 years. And they had proudly announced that they had filmed every single scrap of Poirot that there was. Every book, every short story, everything except, I think, one weird short story where he barely appears and maybe a play. So he'd done every Poirot there was. They just finished it. And now they're like making more. He's like,
I wanted to retire.
Exactly. I feel bad for him.
Courtney Love's daughter, Frances Bean Cobain, once wisely said, Twitter should ban my mom. Maybe she should have said, social media should ban my mom. Unfortunately for Love, that hasn't happened. She was sued by a fashion designer for defamation via Twitter. Is that like defamation of character? I guess so.
Something like that.
That case went away when Love settled for a cool $430,000. Now Love is being sued by one of her attorneys for insisting he was, quote unquote, bought off. That's the quote. During that case, and she's being sued again by that fashion designer because Love defamed her, not on Twitter, not on Facebook, but on Pinterest. Okay? Which means that she defamed her to every woman in America. In any case, in 2014, look for Love to be sued for defaming people on Vine. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop, I guess. I mean, it's just the latest suit. I mean, the woman's like, well, I won $430,000 last time. I might as well sue her again. You know, the first thing you get to say in court is, well, she paid me $430,000 because she defamed me last time. And now she's done it again. And apparently it came up also on Howard Stern. She was on Howard Stern mouthing off. And he's like, yeah, you shouldn't really say that stuff. But she said it anyway.
Yeah. Okay, now we know China is serious about the movie business. China's Deli and Wanda Group is donating $20 million to the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences proposed museum. The conglomerate owns the U.S. movie chain AMC, among other things, and this donation is the second largest single gift, and now they've, at least to the Academy, and now they've raised more than half of the $300 million they're shooting for. In honor of the gift, the Film History Gallery will be called the Wanda Gallery. I don't know that that's such a good idea. In any case, big deal or big whoop, Michael.
Is there any famous Wanda in Hollywood history? I can't think of one.
No.
I think it's a big deal, as it's indicative of the growing importance of the China market to the Hollywood studios.
Okay. Well, you know, look at the Man Chinese Theater, which is no longer the Man Chinese Theater, or Grauman's Chinese Theater on Hollywood Boulevard. The famed landmark is now going to be an IMAX theater. And what is its name now? The TCL Chinese Theater. I never really understood what TCL meant until I understood that, I guess, somebody, say the television manufacturer, TCL, a Chinese television manufacturer, bought the naming rights to Grauman's Chinese Theater.
Wow. And will it be a genuine IMAX screen?
Yes, it is.
All right. Good to know.
If you go to celluloidjunkie.com, there is a whole little film about the, you know, refurbishing.
Real IMAX. Yes. Oh, about this refurbishment.
Yes.
Are they going to bring it back to its former glory?
That's what they hope.
All right.
But now it's time for Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, Michael, I'm going to hand it over to you and let you take it away because I know you know a lot about this, and I certainly have a few things to say. But this is all about digital sales and the tracking of digital sales, or the lack thereof. We can't track these digital sales. That's the big problem.
So this is from a New York Times story. They had a story talking about digital sales and how actors and agents are demanding information on digital sales. By digital sales, we mean when you buy like a movie or a TV episode or a whole season on, say, iTunes or Amazon, or you buy it via maybe straight from the studio and get it digitally downloaded to you via Ultraviolet, or you just access your digital copy there. This is sort of in it. Instead of getting it on DVD and Blu-ray, studios all want you to buy digital copies of movies because it's better for them. They get more money. It's easier for them to sell it to you straight. They don't have to ship a DVD or a Blu-ray to a store or to Amazon and have them ship it to you. They can get a bigger margin. They love it. That's why.
And they don't have to report like how many they've sold to the people who actually want royalties based on how much is sold.
Well, that's part of the problem. As the New York Times says, quote, the business has long used box office numbers, which are publicly sliced and diced ad infinitum. Similarly, disc sales, and I'm speaking now, that means DVDs and Blu-rays, disc sales and rentals for years have been monitored by the Rentrak data company and others. Rentrak, by the way, is what we use to get our worldwide box office figures. Back to the quote. But as consumers shift to new channels like Netflix and Amazon, there are no generally available industry-wide data on the digital performance of individual movies. While the studios get some information, it isn't widely shared with filmmakers, agencies, or the public. And those who hold the data have a distinct advantage when it comes to making deals or deciding which movies to back or what to spend on them. That's the setup for the story. Agents and actors are saying, hey, we want to know how much money you're making. Now, for years, studios were secretive about how much they made on DVDs and Blu-ray. They didn't want to tell people. Once in a great while, they would say, oh, this movie made a ton of movie, like Triple X, the Vin Diesel action film. That went up on DVD. That grossed $100 million in its first week when it was available. And they released a big press release and made a bunch of noise about it. Most of the time, especially when they were making money hand over fist, they didn't want to tell anyone what they were making because they were worried actors would say, hey, I'd like some of that money, please.
In fact, Vin Diesel did say, hey, I'd like some of that money, please, because when they went to make a sequel to Triple X, he said, hey, I'd like some of that money, please. And they said, what money? We don't have any money. We don't know what you're talking about. There's no money here. We barely broke even on this triple X. We might even have to drop an X in the sequel. And he said, yeah, no way. And he was out. He didn't do a sequel.
And the sequel never happened. Or if it did, it did poorly.
I don't know. I'm going to go double check that.
Okay. So that's for 10, 15 years, actors, writers, directors, agents, all the people other than the studios put up with the fact that they have no idea what movies are making on DVD and Blu-ray. To find out, they'd have to sue. They'd have to get an accountant. They'd force them to open the books. It was a laborious process, and you had to trust them unless you went to court. And it's been to their detriment. And in fact, at some points, Hollywood was making more money on DVD and Blu-ray sales than at the box office in North America. So, hey, it's a huge multi-billion dollar business. And for some reason, they never threw up their arms and said, wait a second, this is ridiculous. We want you to report the information publicly every week so we know exactly, at least in gross terms, how much money is being made. But they never did it. Now we're switching to digital. And everybody thinks Blu-ray and DVD are going to fade away. Certainly, they can become a minority soon. And digital will be the dominant way people buy movies and TV shows for their home entertainment. And actors and agents and lawyers and producers and directors are speaking up and saying, all right, enough of this. We want some information. You know, it's outrageous that they put up with it all that time for DVD and Blu-ray. Now maybe they're going to wake up, but they have to draw a line in the sand and say, we're not going forward until you make this information available. Every week, we should have info on DVD sales and sales of movies and TV shows via all these other outlets, just like you do at the box office. If they can track it at the box office, they can certainly track it on Netflix and iTunes and Amazon and DVD and Blu-ray sales and all this stuff and release a dollar figure so that people know how much money they're making, what's the most popular, how are they doing. Right now, if you look at the industry standard journals, they will release a list of the most popular DVD titles, but they'll just rank them. They'll say this was number one, this was number two, this was number three. Whether number one made $4 or $40 or $4 million, you have no way of knowing. And some people say that's the problem. Bruce Gorlick, Rentrak's chief research officer, noted that the wall around digital performance info was simply an extension of confidentiality strictures that have long surrounded video performance numbers. This is from the New York Times. Quote, measurement can equal monetization, can equal a fight. He said, yes, exactly. If people know how much money is being made, they get angry. For example, this year, they made via digital sales $3 billion for the first half of 2013.
Which is huge. That's a third of the theatrical gross.
Right. And that was up 25% from the previous year in that similar time span, which means by the end of the year, they should make $6 to $6.5 to maybe $7 billion on digital sales. What did DVD and Blu-ray do last year? I don't know, but you combine that with this, and you're talking about more money, again, than they're making at the box office, which last year was about $10.8 billion, or at least close to it, or the same.
But here's the thing. Let me just interject here. It's much easier to collect revenue from all these
The problem is not the technical challenge. The problem is they don't want to do it, and they want to keep it secret. Right. So let's not pretend.
No, let me finish, Michael. You never, ever, ever let me finish, okay? And here's what I was going to say. When you have a Blockbuster video or a mom and pop video on every street corner, okay, and you're trying to collect revenue from all of them, well, it is a there is some technology challenges there. But even once you get over those hurdles, and they did get over those hurdles, Rentrak did get over them, you have to then go and tell each and every single one of them, please don't let, you know, the press or anybody else other than us, the studios, and maybe Rentrak know about this, okay, because there's hundreds and thousands of them. Here you've got Amazon and iTunes and maybe a handful of others. It's a heck of a lot easier to control 5 to 10 different players than it is to control 10,000 different players.
But we didn't have the info even when there were 10,000 players. We just didn't have it. For years, when you would ask, say, well, what are they grossing? What are they making? They would just laugh at you and say, oh, we don't talk about that.
Well, you did when it was VHS.
No, and DVD. They wouldn't tell us. Oh, VHS. I don't know about that.
I mean, I used to know how many units sold.
Well, that's not true. At least not for the general public. At least not when I read Billboard and Variety and read the trades. As an outsider, just a journalist, we did not get that information. They would sometimes announce, oh, E.T. sold 20 million copies on VHS when it came out on VHS,
right.
Something like that.
Once it
they
went
would
to
make a big
through.
Announcement when they thought it was to their benefit. But
right.
Weekly, in and out, they did not want to tell you what these movies were making. They did not want to tell you unit sales because you can add and subtract. If they told me it sold 4 million units and it was $90 list price, which is what you're talking about back then, or sale price of $25 for a VHS, well, I can multiply, so I'd figure it out.
Well, I'd have to go back and check.
But they kept that info secret.
But I do know that once they went to sell-through, so that's when things were not $90 priced for rental.
Right, right.
Once they went to sell-through mostly, and the each VHS tape was like $16 to $20 or $30, then all of a sudden we would get the number of units once it was sell-through rather than rental. So I, you know, and it wasn't,
well, you may have gotten them, but it certainly wasn't published in Billboard or Variety.
Probably not. No, it was definitely more of an industry thing. Kind of
right.
An industry.
They wanted to
chart.
Keep it secret. Cause here's somebody lying to the New York Times. Ronald J. Sanders, the president of Worldwide Home Entertainment Distribution at Warner Brothers. He's lying to the New York Times. He says, quote, there's less consumer interest in it. If the general public were more interested in on-demand performance, he said, there would probably, quote, be a stronger push to make it available. Malarkey.
Well, no, he's correct, but what he's correct. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy that he's correct about. He's saying, we don't tell anybody, so there's no interest in something that we don't tell anybody about.
They don't know the information is available or exists. But I've always said there should be one number every week, whatever the highest, just like television. I don't care what the source is. If you're the most popular TV show that week, it should be known, whether you're on Saturday afternoon, late night, on cable, or whatever. So I say, the movies this week, what made the most money? Whether it was on, you know, video on demand or DVD or at the box office worldwide, I don't care. Just give me a number. This movie grossed, you know, $40 million because World War Z came out on DVD this week, and that's the most popular movie this week.
I understand why they separate it, because they're different businesses and they have to be handled.
Sure. But nonetheless, there should always have been numbers for DVD and Blu-ray. It's ridiculous that the actors and the directors and the agents didn't stand up to them and say, this is absurd. You're making a movie. You participate in the profits for the film when it's in theaters, and then they're making even more money on DVD, and they won't tell you about it.
Well, this has been a fight for years. This has been an argument.
Well, yeah, but that's a deal breaker fight. You say, excuse me, you're making $10 billion.
This is what the Writers Guild was on strike for over 100.
$10 billion, that's not worth going on strike for?
Well,
$10 billion?
They're trying to get rid of... Michael, we just talked earlier in this show about how the studios are like, you know, thank you very much for putting butts in seats for 30 years because people couldn't do surround sound at home. But now that we can actually, you know, get rid of you, we don't need you anymore. We're actually not only going to get rid of you, we're going to make sure that nobody else can create technology.
I'm not surprised that the studio played tough. I'm just surprised that the actors and directors and agents and all the talent stood up, let them hide the facts about DVD sales for 10, 15 years. I'm glad that they're maybe speaking up. I think it's worth striking about because it's billions of dollars at stake and they're completely in the dark about what's going on. If you're going to go on strike, I think $10 billion is worth it.
Well, yes. And I think the Writers Guild went on strike for 100 days. And one of the big things was they wanted digital. They wanted to get, they gave up on DVD and they wanted to get a bigger piece of digital. And they were struggling over that.
Right. And one of the problems is that they didn't also say, but step one is you got to start publishing what's going on and how much money you're making. You know, before you could fight over the pie, you got to know how big the pie is. And I would say, you know what? No, this has to become just as commonplace as the weekend box office.
Well, here's my question. Why you say, well, you should be telling us this. Why? It's not your business. You're not a part of it.
Well, actually, it is a business because they're created afresh every movie that you make, and people are profit participants in them.
No, it's not the public's business. It's not, you know, they don't have a financial stake in it.
Sure, they do. People have bad points and stuff on DVD and thing. People have points in syndication on television. They found out they're lying to them.
It's not a consumer's. Why should I as Universal Pictures or Universal Pictures Home Video.
The only reason they're hiding is because they don't want to share the profits. But the reason why they should do it for PR purposes is because the weekend box office is the best advertisement movies have. It's a great advertisement. Every outlet in the world talks about the weekend box office, and it's a huge driver of business. And if you want people to be paying, if you want people to download World War Z and pay for that movie when it comes out on video on demand, and believe me, people are screaming at me every day, why won't you cover the video on demand release of this movie? Why won't you cover the video on demand release? Because it comes out like 2 weeks, 3 weeks before the DVD. And I say, hey, I only cover Blu-ray and DVD. I don't do video on demand. So I'm sorry, but I just won't cover it. The people are begging constantly for attention. You want to get attention? Release what the box office figures are. Say, World War Z grossed $40 million this week. How? A video on demand. Wow. And then more people go, I didn't realize I didn't know it was out. oh, I didn't realize you could do that. Oh, you can go to iTunes and download a movie. They think everyone knows this happens, but they don't, especially older people. So you know what? You want to educate people. You want to bring attention to your product. Let them know what the ratings are for a TV show. Let them know what the grosses are for a video on demand release. It's good PR. I know they're scared to do it. They think hiding the facts will keep them from having to share profits with all the people who make the movies happen. But that's, you know, I think that's backward thinking. I think you should want to share the profits. If it's a big success, everybody's happy.
How do you really feel about this subject? I mean, like, if you were to really care about it?
The more transparent, the better.
Okay, just checking.
Don't lie, kids. Cheaters never prosper.
No, but you know who does prosper?
Who?
People who download Showbiz Sandbox on a regular basis. It's free. In fact,
how much do we make from it? Nothing.
Well, you know.
We've just had a full transparent accounting.
That's true. Just go and ask RentTrack. So listen, you know, you can actually download our show from iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give away podcasts for free, anywhere they aggregate podcasts. That's where you can find our show, Showbiz Sandbox. So please do rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators. It does help us out. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's show, including those from Ann Thompson. I'd like to thank her from IndieWire for joining us. I really appreciate her being here. All of those stories can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com, in the show notes for episode 205.
Where can also Ann Thompson be found, by the way?
She can be found at IndieWire.com or ThompsonOnHollywood.com.
All right, great.
You can also email us. Dirt at showbizsandbox.com is the email address. That's D-I-R-T at showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call and leave us a voicemail like the anonymous listener did at the head of the show. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. All of that information, as well as ways to follow us, we're on Twitter. Handle is Showbiz Sandbox. We're also on Facebook, where you can find us if you search for Showbiz Sandbox. We have a page where you can, I guess, like us, not follow us. But all of this information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group, MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, who is mgmt.com.
Buy their new album.
Yes, they have an album that came out today.
That's right. So send them to the top of the chart.
It's an eponymous album, I believe.
That's right. MGMT.
Yes. Now, Michael, you have a website, bookfilter.com. And I guess, is there any other website that we should be mentioning?
Bookfilter.com is it right now. I have my own website, michaelgiltz.com, where you can find my work. I'm still working to launch bookfilter.com officially, but I appreciate all the people who have been by and checked it out and left comments and told me how they think about it.
I thought you were going to promote opensourcesgreat.com.
That's a good website.
Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.